It's the CougarFan.com Rise and Shout Podcast, episode 347, and I am your host, Adam Mangum. In this week's show, we talk about that result against UMass. Matt and I were there at Gillette Stadium. We talked about our experience. We talk about the rest of the season and what success looks like for BYU football. We then move on to basketball, talk about their first two games and look at the non-conference schedule and what that looks like. And then we also talk about the stupid decision by the stupid double NCAA to hand out stupid punishments for things that they shouldn't be as concerned about as they are. So you can kind of tell how that's going to go from my perspective. This is the CougarFan.com Rise and Shout Podcast. You can find this show on Twitter at BYU_RiseShout and join the conversation with us there. And you can listen to Matt and I right now. Matt, I feel like we should do this entire show in Boston accents.
We should. We should do it in Boston accents. Yours is much better than mine, though.
Yeah, we've covered that already in a previous show. Didn't we do like a whole segment in Boston accents once?
No, we did a whole show in bad British accents, which happened to be the one time the one week that my old boss decided he wanted to listen to a show.
Did we really do the whole show in bad British accents?
Most of it. Most of it, because he played clips of it while I was standing in his office with other people. That was a rough day. That was a rough day at work.
Yeah, that sounds pretty rough there, buddy.
Please don't. Because this will be the second time.
Please don't what? What am I doing? What's bothering
See,
you?
You break into the Boston accent. I've noticed that you break into the Boston accent, our recent trip to the homeland withstanding. Or notwithstanding, or whatever the term is. When you're tired, when you get especially angry.
Yes, yes. My wife has noted those things as well.
Or otherwise, like, really fired up.
Yes, yes. I can break into it. Or if I am talking to a Bostonian, sometimes it'll just come out. Like, I was going through security to leave Logan Airport there in Boston on Sunday, and I had my new Patriots hat on, right, which I was very excited about.
It's a great hat. I wish I would have bought one.
And the guy says to me, he says, "Ah, they're Patriots fans all the way in Minnesota." Huh? And I said to him, I said, "No, I grew up here. I grew up in Norwell." And he's like, "Ah, awesome. Oh, have a nice trip there, buddy." And I said, "You see you later. See you later, buddy."
Say hi to your mother for me.
Say hi to your mother for me. No. What? No. No. That's terrible. This is a BYU show.
That's a Mark Wahlberg line. It's a Boston thing. It was on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, there's funny. A lot of things on the Saturday Night Live we're
not
going to repeat.
It was funny. All right, come on.
You're terrible. All right, so... So anyway, Matt, we had a good time. We'll get into that in a second. But let's go to the CougarFan.com. Cougars in the news. You still laughing about your Wahlberg joke?
I'm laughing that you repeated it before you realized what I had said. Cougars in the news!
Get all of your BYU sports news at CougarFan.com. Matt, Fred Warner, as we speak, is having a big game in the Monday Night Football game for the San Francisco 49ers. Yesterday, Kyle Van Noy had a big game for the Patriots. Unfortunately, it was in a resounding loss by the Patriots. And then Taysom Hill doing Taysom things made a linebacker look like a little child.
Yeah, that's what he does, because he's basically a linebacker. I will say this, Fred Warner, just now, I'm watching this game on a third and goal, straight up stopped Barkley in the hole, stuffed him. And Giants had to settle for a field goal. Yeah, it was awesome.
That's awesome. I mean, and it's against the Giants too, which is even better. Down with the Giants. Where was this question? I put it in the wrong place. So Jimmer had like a 71-point game. Okay. Jimmer had a 71.
I believe it was 75 points. Wasn't 75 points?
Whatever. I don't know. It was a lot of points.
More points than some teams score in a game.
Yeah. So our first tweet bag question of the day.
Tweetback
comes from Facebook. You can join the conversation on Facebook at facebook.com/RiseAndShout from Johnny Ashton.
Hey, Johnny.
He says, which Cougar, past or present, is most likely to play in a future NBA game? Preseason and summer league do not count. Okay. After a 75-point performance, Jimmer isn't a bad bet, but his pick, Johnny's pick, is Elijah Bryant. Matt, more likely to appear in an NBA game next, Jimmer or Elijah?
Jeez, Eli. Like what? What's that?
EB.
I guess, but I don't think the likelihood is super high for either of them.
It's Jimmer. Jimmer's
never coming back to the NBA. Everybody just needs to just accept that.
No, Jimmer.
He's found his thing. That he's going to tear it up over there. He's going to make some money. That's just the way it's going to be. He might play in that league till he's 40. I don't know.
Okay, I'm gonna throw one at you. Maybe the most likely one is Yoeli Childs. What? Did I just throw that down?
That's interesting. I think I like that.
That could be the next one. So good question, Johnny. The women's volleyball team, Matt, still good.
Yep. Still rolling.
Still number one. Straight sets this week. They just keep dominating. And then they had a freshman because having so the West Coast Conference Player of the Week award basically should just be the BYU Player of the Week award.
Okay. Yeah, that's where we are.
That's where we are at this point. The winner this week, for the first time this year, was freshman middle blocker Heather Knighting. I don't know how to say her last name.
I thought that was the right way to say it, but I'm just gonna have to. We'll roll with whatever you just said.
It would be cool if it was Netting, just because of volleyball, but I think it's Knighting. She had double-digit kills, 6 blocks in each of BYU's matches last week, and en route to being named there. The Cougars hit 537, it was good for the 4th best mark in a 3-set match by any team in the country this year. Anyway, that was big, and that is the 6th WCC Player of the Week award for BYU this year in 12 weeks of competition. Ronnie Jones Perry has 3, Lindy Haddock Epic has 2, and now Heather Knighting has 1. So, like I said, it's the BYU award. They have 3 more matches before postseason begins. And not likely to drop any of those matches. So they
not likely to drop a set in any of those matches.
Yeah, not likely to drop a set. And so they're going to roll into the postseason on quite a run. That being said, maybe the one bad thing about this last part of the weeks is they're not going to maybe get any challenges. So I don't know if that matters or not, but that's kind of where they're at. There's not much they can do about the schedule at this point. So good luck to the Cougars this week in women's volleyball. All right, Matt, so we were in Massachusetts, Foxborough, Gillette Stadium, to watch UMass, and we've got some questions. But before we talk about the game and the experience at Gillette, Boston is just a lot of fun.
Oh, it's maybe the greatest city in the United States.
We almost went to Hamilton. By almost, I mean we walked by it and checked ticket prices and saw that it was like $400 a seat. So we didn't actually almost go.
But yeah, I think we made the right decision there. Just because if I'm going to go see Hamilton and not take my wife, there's going to be a price paid for that.
Well, the price is $400 apparently.
It's going to be greater than $400. Mm-hmm.
I see what you're saying. We walked around. We ate cannolis. Oh, man.
I think I had too many cannolis.
You had a lot of food. But you exercised a lot, so you had a lot of food.
I was so hungry. I ate so much food this weekend. It was awesome.
It was wicked awesome. We went to Quincy Market.
We ate Italian in the North End.
We ate Italian in the North End. We walked by the harbor. And
it was great.
We had to.
I ran from Cambridge down to Fenway.
Yeah.
Back.
Yeah. From our hotel down to Fenway.
Along the
Charles River.
There you go. That's where I was.
There you go. Here's the thing. Here's what I don't understand about all this. When we moved to Massachusetts, you were 7. I was 11.
Yeah, but if you go back and look at footage from me talking in high school, I had a Boston accent.
I know.
My kids think it's hilarious.
What happened to you?
I don't know.
I don't know. You just can't. You can't turn it back on, dude. You can't turn it back on. So what was I going to say? Oh, so looking at that, you know, the one of the craziest things about the weekend, though, was Clemson fans everywhere.
Oh, they were everywhere.
There was orange everywhere. I mean, we saw the BYU fans in the city as well. But Clemson fans were everywhere, except for Saturday night after the game started. Then you couldn't see. There was no orange anywhere. They were all in Chestnut Hill watching their Tigers.
Yeah, all we saw around Saturday night were Bruins fans on their way to the game.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So we had a good time. But Matt, the experience at the stadium, let's talk about that. Our brother Don has the first tweet bag question from Twitter.
Tweet bag.
That's at @BYU_RiseShout if you want to do that. Don says, what was the UMass BYU fan ratio? And would you go next year if the game is on campus at Amherst? Okay, so let's take the first one. I would say it was like 60-40 UMass fans to BYU fans.
Feel like it was maybe just a touch closer than that. Because even up in that club section, there were a lot of BYU fans.
Yeah, but the UMass section below us was lower, and we are factoring out they had a bunch of high school band kids there for the halftime show, none of whom stayed. Like, they all left after they performed. I'm not counting them in this at all.
But and if you also don't include the UMass band, I think that kind of skews the visual as well.
Yeah,
because that was a whole that was like a whole section.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it was a lot more BYU fans than I anticipated, I'll put it that way.
I will say this. I feel like on third down, when BYU was on defense, the BYU fans were louder than the UMass fans were on defense.
UMass fans are terrible. Like, half of them
weren't even watching the game. It was weird.
They weren't watching the game. They weren't. And as soon as the tide turned, they were out. They didn't cheer again.
Right. People started leaving.
People started leaving
in the
really
second
early.
Quarter, people are like, all right, we're done.
People started leaving really early, but, you know, it's still sad that we're like the biggest win in their history.
Yeah, they loved it.
And they loved it. But we got, we had some good interaction with the UMass fans.
Zero negative interactions. Even like the drunk guy at the end who tried to trade me hats.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
It was weird, but it wasn't
negative.
Why don't
you take my UMass hat? I'll take your BYU hat. And
don't need your sweaty UMass hat.
It's a military UMass hat.
This hat was a gift from my wife. It has sentimental value. Man, I was glad I came up with that.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah, but you made the mistake of making eye contact. I don't make eye contact.
Listen, the first time I made eye contact with that guy was about 10 minutes before.
I believe it, a urinal.
And it was accidental. But yeah, that's where it happened. That's where it happened. Wow. He just started talking to me.
He just started talking to you.
Followed us out of the stadium.
He hates Mitt Romney, apparently.
He does. He agrees with his views.
Yeah, he agrees with all of his views.
But has some colorful language to describe how he feels
about
him.
That guy's a loser.
You're paraphrasing.
I am editing significantly. Not paraphrasing, I'm editing.
But you see, in Massachusetts, those aren't swear words.
Yeah. That's lots of swear words. But there was that other old guy that stopped us and said how much he loved Provo.
Yeah.
We went there last year, and he said he started tailgating, and they didn't get arrested. So
they didn't even arrest him for tailgating. He thought that was great.
He thought that was great. I assume that means he was drinking some beer.
I think that the only place where people tailgate without that is in Provo. So
yeah, I believe that's true. All right, anything else about Gillette Stadium or the experience before we talk a little bit about the game?
Gillette Stadium is awesome, and I can't wait to go back and watch the Patriots play a game there.
Yeah, that would be a lot of fun. That'd be a lot of fun. And
wearing my brand new Kyle Van Noy jersey.
Yeah, I mean, when we grew up, we got to talk about that. You got a Kyle Van Noy Patriots jersey.
Yes, I did. It was awesome. Yeah. And it is awesome.
Yeah, you wore it home on the plane, didn't you?
I've worn it for probably half of the hours I've been home since the trip.
Okay, too much information. If you slept in it, we don't need to know that, okay?
Does falling asleep watching a football game count as sleeping in it?
Do you know what sleeping means?
Well, then the answer to your question is yes, I have slept in it.
All right, so we had a good time. It was fun. As far as the game goes, Matt, I have a couple of thoughts, and then I'll give you your chance to offer your thoughts about the game.
Oh, great. Okay. Appreciate that.
And if you hadn't checked out our halftime shows, we had a really good one live from the stadium You can check those out every game at facebook.com/riseandshout. We do them live there on Facebook. Neil Pau had two really great catches on Saturday, and I have been pretty rough on a few of the wide receivers, him included, and I got to give him props. They were two very hard, good throws by Wilson, by the way, because it was the only place that they were going to be complete, right? But still difficult catches with guys, with good coverage. So hats off to him on that. Defense has had four good games in a row. Okay, so I'm looking at this right now, Matt, and I'm looking at the advanced stats. We are a top 40 defense as of right now.
33rd, that's not awful, right?
33rd, according to Football Outsiders, we're the 33rd best defense in the country. And I just have to say, a few weeks ago, I think we were being very, not a few weeks, maybe a month and a half ago, when the Utah State and Boise games took place and the defense got torched a little bit. We were pretty rough on them. If you look right now, Boise and, I mean, it was Washington, sorry, Washington and Utah State. Utah State may end up being the best team we played all year by advanced stats, depending on Utah ends up. And I think the problem is everybody looks at that loss against Utah State and Washington as Washington was acceptable, even getting blown up like that, because Washington's an elite team. But Utah State, and I thought that at the time, Utah State might be they're definitely one of the top three teams we played this year, both on the eye test and the advanced stats, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what they do here in the next couple weeks. That may change how we feel about that. And then the last one is I ran into the mom of the El Bakri boys.
That's pretty cool.
So I saw her. She had the sweatshirt on that had their two names and numbers on the back. So I went up and said hi and told her how her sons are great or whatever. And she said, you know, because El Bakri dropped a pass, Braden did, and according to her, and I don't know if this is true, he'd never dropped one since he had been at BYU. I don't ever remember him dropping any passes. And when she talked to him about it, the wind was nuts and said he couldn't figure out where the ball was going to go. So the wind was nuts. We saw it with the punts. We saw it. And it's amazing, quite frankly, that Wilson was able to complete over 60% of his passes, right?
And some of them swirling wind. I mean, it was crazy.
Swirling, crazy wind. But it just made me think. She said she had this relief that they won, right? Because she really wants her son as a senior to get a chance to play in a bowl game. And I think we sometimes forget as fans, as analysts, whatever, that there are actual people playing these games and families and friends that are invested in it in a way that we aren't as fans, right? We're invested for ourselves, right? For our enjoyment. And they're this mom of two kids on the team, I shouldn't say call them kids, they're not kids, but two guys on the team. She wants a bowl game because her senior son, she wants him to get his season extended another month, right? Get another chance to play. And so when I hear people say, and I'm anti this anyway, but when I hear people say 6-6 team, we shouldn't even accept a bowl, there are lots of reasons to say no to that, including you get a whole nother month of practice, morons who say that. Is that too harsh for me to say that?
I think it is stupid to not take a whole nother month of practice.
Yeah, it's absolutely moronic that you would say no. But anyway, the other piece is the personal piece of it. Right now, should 6-6 teams get to have a bowl game? That's a different debate, right? But that's the system, and you should take advantage of it.
Well, and it's a free market, right? If the 6-6 team playing a goal in a bowl game generates money for somebody, then 6-6 teams will go to bowl games.
Correct. That is kind of how it works. So, Matt, what any thoughts that you had on the game overall?
I will say this. I went back and looked. You know, they've replayed the game and all this, and there were a couple things that did stick out to me in addition to what you just talked about. And they're both – on offense and defense, it's really the same thing that I observed and was pleased to see, that at halftime we made adjustments that changed what we were doing in the second half on both sides of the ball that made us more successful, that adjusted to what that team was doing and doing well, took some of those things away or took advantage of what the defense was giving you. And that's something we've complained about, I feel like, not every week this year, but several weeks this year, about especially on defense, how they're not making adjustments. And the one that really sticks out in my mind was in the first half, you look out on the edges, and we were giving them those really big cushions and those quick throw routes, the 10-yard curls and some of these out routes and things were wide open because the cushions were so big. And we come out in the second half, and they were playing a little bit more press. The defensive backs were coming up close to the line of scrimmage, and a lot of those passes went away because you saw that their quarterback, he started to get happy feet a little bit, and it worked for us making that adjustment. And so I was really pleased to see that. I think that's something we'd struggled with on both offense and defense. I'm hoping that translates well over the next two or three games, right? And we're going to talk more about what's going to happen here with New Mexico State this weekend. But if you want to have a shot against Utah, you're going to have to be able to make halftime adjustments on defense. So that was encouraging to see.
Yeah, for sure, I agree. Anything else on UMass before we move on to some other topics?
They are not good.
They're terrible.
But it's great to pick up a win. It's great to come out to get out to Massachusetts, pick up the win against a team that embarrassed you at home last year. I think that when you talk about comparisons between last year and this year and has the team really improved, I think this game's a decent measuring stick for that.
You just stole the next question, dude.
Oh, sorry.
You're jumping ahead.
What? I don't see the next. What is this? Is this somewhere on the agenda?
It's right after Matt's thoughts on the agenda. You're stealing Johnny Dangerman's question.
All right. Go ahead.
So at Johnny Dangerman.
No, he does a specific. Whatever. Read the question.
Oh my gosh! What he does specifically? Oh, you're terrible. Okay, John says, okay, my dad says if we don't beat Utah, the season is a failure. I see some signs of improvement, and while the season was a roller coaster, at least there were some brief highs. Who is right, Matt? Who's right, Johnny Dangerman or Old Man Dangerman?
Old Man Dangerman.
So
who do I think is right here? I can't agree that if we don't beat Utah, this season is a failure. You look at what we all thought we wanted out of 2018 in August is exactly what we're going to get. We're going to get a 6-win team that goes to a bowl game with a loss to Utah, right? And that is some improvement. And now getting back to the point I started that you yelled at me for. I think this UMass game is a good measuring stick. This is a team that came into Provo last year and totally embarrassed us. We looked foolish in that game. We looked clueless and lost. It's a low point. In my opinion, it's a low point in the program, right? One of the greatest wins in UMass football history, whatever. But that is a low point for our program, was that loss at home to UMass. So getting back to playing this team on the road and being able to do what you do when you end up in the fourth quarter and you're resting starters and all this because you're comfortably out in front, that shows to me some arc, some progress. Right now, would we like the progress to be faster? Yes. Do we want this team to win 10 games? Yes. Do we feel like a team that beat Wisconsin should have beat Utah State? Yeah, in our heads, I understand why that's true, but Adam will be really quick to point out to us that the advanced stats tell us that Utah State's a better team. So I think that there are some signs of improvement. The season absolutely was a roller coaster. The win over Wisconsin was one of the greatest moments. Like, I will always remember watching that game. That was a ton of fun, right? But we haven't had a point this year that I feel like was as low as the loss to UMass at home. There just hasn't been.
Yeah,
and the team does. We're better than we were 12 months ago.
So if the question is about improvement, you laid it out really well that we have improved. I'll add a few additional points to that, which is on every metric we have improved. Right, the offense still is way below average, but they're better. And quite frankly, we put together some good games lately against bad teams, but last year we didn't have good games against bad teams, except for San Jose State, right? We were terrible against Portland State, if you remember. We ended up winning that game, but we looked awful, and it was, little did we know, that was really a preview of how terrible the season was going to be, because we didn't win again until almost November, when we dominated San Jose State. And then we beat UNLV and Hawaii, but we didn't dominate either of those games against absolutely brutally bad teams and lost to UMass. So when if anybody thinks we didn't improve to all the points you just made and a couple that I added, I just think that's overly cynical, emotional talk, because we certainly improved, not just by the record, but what happened on the field. As far as failure goes, it all depends on what your expectations were. If you, like you said, if you were expecting 6-6 in a bowl, and hey, we beat Wisconsin and we were one play away from beating Boise State in Boise, right? And by the way, that totally changes, I think, how people feel about this season right now.
Okay. Yeah, if
we're already at 6 wins.
Yeah, if Zach Wilson has a little bit more experience at the end of that, you know, by the time you get to that game, and decisions shake out a little bit differently, you probably win it.
You probably win that game. So, again, but if you thought we were going to rebound to 8 or 9 wins this year, then, yeah, it's a failure compared to those expectations. But I don't think it's a failure. So I think, John, you're right. Our next one comes from Chase Blyle. I'm going to paraphrase. He did this via email, and you can email us at riseandshoutpod@gmail.com. He says he thinks the BYU offense is bad because we have a hard time recruiting explosive playmakers. He says he always complained about Anai, but now he wants to give him a little bit more credit. And, you know, that the coaches, you know, looked better when they had Taysom Hill and Jamal Williams around, and things have changed. You know, maybe we should be looking for an offensive staff that has demonstrated an ability to take average offensive playmakers and turn out good offenses. Matt, you and I have talked about this. There are not big position playmakers outside of maybe Bushman on that offensive staff. I don't think any of the running backs would you call them like big time playmakers.
No, I don't think we have any explosive. We don't have any explosive weapons on offense.
No, and among the wide receivers, Hefo's good, I think, is above average. And I think Romney may become that guy someday, may be an explosive guy, but he's not today. So, you're right, but here's the thing. We've often had above average offenses in the history of this program without explosive playmakers. Now, we have never had elite offenses without explosive playmakers, right? That I can think of. I went back and started looking at it. You know, some of the best offenses we had a, you know, Austin Colley, Dennis Pitta, right?
Look at that offense. You have Harvey four Onga. Guys that spent some time in the league.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, who were regularly touching the ball, right? Yeah. I mean.
Yeah. So, you know, and Taysom Hill. I don't know if any of those were elite offenses he played on, but from a running standpoint, they were. That is a problem. But this isn't a new problem for BYU, to not have explosive playmakers on offense from a recruiting perspective. That's not new. That's been around for a long time, and some years you get a few, and that might be Gunnar Romney, right? And a couple of these guys that are in high school. There's a couple wide receivers that are very well thought of. So I think they may get back to that. The problem for me, I don't think their problem this year is a lack of playmakers. Just that, right? Like, that's not the only problem, I guess, to rephrase. We've got bigger schematic problems, just like we had last year. Just not calling the right plays at the right time, and maybe in some instances not playing the right players.
No, yeah, I hear you. But, you know, the version of this question that I'm more concerned about is actually the defense.
Why is that?
You know, and you and I started talking about this a little bit over the weekend, but the thing I look at recent players from BYU that are finding success defensively at the next level, right? Yes. And the two that come to mind immediately are Kyle Van Noy and Fred Warner, right? And I'm trying to Google it, and I've forgotten his name. But who's the defensive back in San Diego? Who is breaking back into the starting lineup?
Michael Davis?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, and he wasn't like a shutdown guy for us, right?
Yeah, he was. Right? His junior year, I think he played one of the best defensive back seasons in the history of BYU. So I'm going to disagree with you there. He was, and then senior year, if you remember, he came back, and he's said this since, that he took his eye off the ball, right? He didn't try as hard, and he ended up not even starting at the end of that senior year. I'm going to disagree with you. I think Davis was one of the best defensive backs, coverage corners we've ever had. But all these guys you're talking about had otherworldly talent. Davis was super fast, big and strong. Kyle Van Noy was amazing, right? And Fred Warner was amazing, right?
But did Dan Sorensen have otherworldly talent?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Any of these guys that make it to the NFL have otherworldly talent.
So, okay, but if
Sorensen was amazing. He was amazing at BYU.
So here's where we're going to get to my point.
Okay.
I look at the roster today. Do you see a guy like that?
Sione Takitaki is playing in the NFL next year. Fourth-round draft choice, I'm guessing. Peely will play in the NFL. And I think there's probably, I bet you there's one or two other younger guys that have a shot at it. But you're saying no.
I'm saying maybe Takitaki.
What about Peely? What about Tonga, I mean? Tonga's who I've been meaning to say, Tonga. Tonga's going to play at the next level, I think.
I mean, we'll see, right? But I think I guess you don't know this far in advance, but like that next generation of players, that's where we're really going to find this out. Like, can this staff go get
a
player like that?
That is a big question, because all the people we're talking about were recruited by the
previous administration.
Right? So Troy Warner was another guy I thought could play at the next level, but I mean, right now he's not even starting, right? So at safety, he's, you know, him and Austin Lee are sharing a lot of reps, but you know, I thought Troy Warner could be that guy too, and maybe he still can be, right? One season doesn't totally define a person, but your point is valid. We don't know yet till they start playing. I will say this though, on offense, they seem to have recruited some good guys.
Yeah, they've got some. There's some great young talent on offense, and we'll have to see how it pans out, you know, over time.
Yeah, we'll see. Holker, but I guess Holker wasn't recruited by them, was he? No.
Nope.
But obviously Romney and Wilson are the top ones that come to mind. So, Matt, New Mexico State, we're not going to preview this. We're going to kill them. They're even worse than UMass.
They are who we thought they were.
We will dominate them. They'll win. I'm not going to spend any time.
So bad.
They're really bad. So I'm going to go to a question by Justin Sweeney. Talking about that Utah game that John just referenced. You can pick only one Utah victory, end of this year or game one in 2019. Which do you pick? Hashtag tweetbag. Matt, do you want, if you could just pick a win, we're going to lose one, we're going to win one, which one do you want?
I want to win the 2019 game.
Same here. It's easy for me. This season would look a little better with that. Actually, it would look a lot better. But next year, if you won that first game, now all of a sudden you're a ranked team, probably, in week two. And everything's, you know, lined up to have a really cool season.
Because once you get to the end of September next year, like, you've got a lot. You could pile up some wins. And so if you can get through those first four games, picking up a win against a Utah team that today you should lose to, you could really have something there.
So also off of Twitter, Lavelle's Godson at 1984 Best Year. It's a great handle. Does this team have what it takes to beat the Utes? Hashtag tweet bag. Lots of A's in there. Matt, the Football Outsiders gives us a 19% chance to beat Utah, too high or too low?
It's probably about right, maybe a little high.
It feels high to me. I feel like, and this happens with the advanced stats, right? They're taking into account the whole year. I think Utah is playing much better. Now, you can't do this, but if you chopped off the first third of their season, I think you'd say we, you know, judging off just that, you'd say we have like a 10% chance, right, to do it. Now, I think we could pull it off, and we'll definitely talk about that more next week about what that could look like. But no, not likely. Matt, college football playoff rankings. How do you like those?
I like that stuff.
So Matt, I'm just curious from your perspective, if should Central Florida be in this? Last year you were adamant that Central Florida should not be on here, should not be in the college football playoffs. What is your thought now?
My opinion remains unchanged. Okay. Like you look at their schedule, they do not. I want the best four teams in the country. That's if you can only get four teams in that playoff. I want legitimately the best four teams. I don't care if some of them are from the same conference. I don't care if they're all undefeated. I want the four best teams.
Yeah.
And you cannot convince me right now that UCF is one of the four best teams in the country. I understand that they're undefeated. I understand they can only play the teams that are on their schedule in order to prove their point. I understand that because I've argued all of those same things as a BYU fan in seasons that we were good, right? But none of those seasons were about getting into a four-team playoff.
No.
And, you know, sure, you've got some big wins against the likes of, you know, Temple and East Carolina and SMU, right?
I'm sensing some sarcasm from you.
So there's nothing on this resume that screams like this team is a top 10 team.
Mm. All right, fair enough. So the top four today is Alabama, Clemson, Notre Dame, and Michigan. Would you put money on those four making the playoff or a different four making the playoff? What's more likely?
I think it's going to be those four.
Oh, it's not going to be those four. Something will happen. Michigan will lose to Ohio State.
I think the likely one is Syracuse beats Notre Dame.
Syracuse is decent. I mean, they certainly could. I mean, it's not going to be... So that's why I'm saying between those two, I kind of feel like something's going to happen there, and it's not going to be those four. I think I'll be shocked if Bama and Clemson aren't there, but I'm not going to be shocked if Notre Dame or Michigan lose against another good team down the stretch.
The only game that I'm worried about for Michigan at this point is Ohio State at the end of November. Because now that they're going to have Northwestern in the Big Ten Championship game, they'll smoke Indiana.
Yeah.
So the question mark remains, like, if it had been a different team going to the Big Ten Championship game, I would be more nervous about Michigan. But I still feel like Michigan's going to beat Ohio State. I think Ohio State is a little overrated, and their weaknesses have been exposed. And Michigan's playing better football now than they were earlier this year.
Ohio State has lost one game, dude. And they just went into East Lansing and absolutely dominated Michigan State. I get that they are have not played as well as Michigan, but I think there's a very good chance. I give Michigan at best a 60% chance to win that game. At best.
And the other thing too to think about, and I know that this is going to kind of contradict what I just said, is that Michigan Northwestern played earlier, and Michigan only won by 3 points.
Yeah, but
Michigan's playing better football now than they were.
I agree with you. If they get in that game, they're gonna smoke them. But you know, the computers right now give Michigan like a 55% chance of winning that game on the road, right? And that's a big part of it to me is where it's played, too, right? If this were in the Big House, I'd feel much better about Michigan's chances.
But if Michigan and Notre Dame both drop one, then does UCF move up and in?
No. I don't disagree with anything you said about UCF. If I were the committee, I would be very tempted to give UCF a spot if those two things happen. But the problem is this. Are you going to put him in over a one-loss Big 12 champ? No. So the Big 12 would have to, something weird would have to happen there, right? West Virginia and Oklahoma would both have to end up losing two games, okay? So that's not going to happen. Are you going to put them over even a two-loss Georgia team where they're who loses to Bama, right? Maybe.
Right.
Maybe. Are you going to put them over a one-loss Washington State Pac-12 champ? No. Right? You're not. So, you know, you look at that and you go, okay, well then UCF's road to get in there is basically utter chaos has to happen, right?
Right.
And they have to win the rest of their games, which isn't a given either. You know, I'm trying to think who they got left. Cincinnati and Southern Florida.
South Florida.
Oh, maybe it is a gimme. They finished that.
Those are both bunnies. Yeah,
they should be able to get those. I had forgotten who they had left. But you know, you look at I don't know, it'd be interesting. Well, let's move off football. We got other stuff to talk about today. Let's talk about basketball. So BYU lost their opening game to, you know, top 10 Nevada, right? And they hung with them for a lot of the game. Matt, did that loss, even though it's a loss, give you hope for the potential of this team?
Oh, absolutely. To be able to hang with a top 10 team?
Yeah.
Absolutely gives me hope for the potential of the team. I mean, you're pretty early on in these guys playing together and getting chemistry figured out and all those types of things. I mean, that's a great sign.
Yeah, and without one of your better players, right? In Nick Emery, who's supposed to be part of the team, and on the road, right? And so lots of good to have there. Now they come back and then beat Utah Valley. And Matt, that one was a little closer than I think I would have liked. Does that, to the opposite side of that, does that one give you any pause that at home against Utah Valley, we only win by 10?
No, I mean, winning by 10 is still, I mean, that's still a double-digit win. You know, I know you feel like, yeah, we ought to just smoke these guys. But if you look at the halftime score, you know, we're up by 13, which feels a lot more comfortable, right?
Right.
I'm sorry. We was basically tied at the half.
No? Yeah, it was tied at half. We dominated in the second half.
And so,
dominated,
yeah,
maybe a
right.
little stronger.
So I guess it's the reverse of what I'm going to say, of what I was going to say, right? If you had played the way you played, if you played a full game like you played the second half, we're not even having this conversation.
No, that's accurate. So we had one tweet bag question about that Utah Valley game off of Facebook. It was from Travis Brewer. He says, do you think Haas can play all year the way he did during the second half of the UVU game? If he can keep that up, I think we can get second place in the conference. And if Baxter can learn to play defense, we might be able to do even better. So Matt, can Haas play that way throughout the season more consistently, like he did in the second half against Utah Valley?
I don't know, right? He didn't do it for a full game against Utah
Valley. That's my problem with us thinking that Haas is going to suddenly turn it on. Is he's been so inconsistent that I hesitate to say yes. I hope so, and he certainly has the talent to do it, and he didn't do a lot of the dumb turnovers against Utah Valley that unfortunately had some of those against Nevada that has been kind of plagued him for his first 2 years at BYU. So I hope so, and this team becomes a different team if he's doing, you know, if he's like he was in that second half more consistently. So Matt, you look at the rest of this schedule, and there's some big out-of-conference games left, okay? So you got coming up some just terrible teams for the next couple weeks. But after that, you get Houston, who's a top 40 team, okay? Then another couple weeks of decent teams that'll be good wins if you can get them, Illinois State, Weber State, Utah State. Then you get Utah, who's probably pretty similar to us, you know, top 70 type of team. And then you finish off with San Diego State and Mississippi State on the road. San Diego State, probably maybe a top 60, top 50 team. We'll see how they end up doing this year. And then Mississippi State is a ranked team, and could be, at least a lot of people believe, they'll be a top 20 type of team this year. How many of those games does BYU need to win? Before we get into the conference schedule, because the conference schedule is what it is, right? We'll get to that in a second, but how many of these games do they need to win? I feel like they need to win one of the set of Houston, Utah, San Diego State, and Mississippi State for sure, maybe two of those. But they definitely, they got to get one win against a top 75 team before you get to the conference, into the conference play. What says you?
I almost feel like you need a second one of those.
You may be right. You may be right.
I think you want this to feel a little lopsided when you get into the conference games. When I look at those teams you just listed, I think you might need to win two of those.
But do you feel differently if you win just one, but you beat everybody else? So you don't drop, against those road games, Illinois State and Weber State, for example, those are not two terrible teams. Those are two decent teams.
Yeah, right? But in my mind, when I'm answering your question, I'm assuming that you need to win those.
Yeah, see, but historically, you're going to drop one of those games.
Right.
So I guess what I'm saying is, if you don't do that and you win one, do you feel differently? You're saying no. You've got to win all those games and win two of the four of those better teams to really get that resume in shape for March.
Yeah, if you think you're going to the dance, you've got to do something a little bit differently than, what we have consistently done and that one basketball preview that we talked to a couple of weeks ago joked about, right? Where you can kind of just fill in all the blanks on, we're going to win about this many games, you're going to drop, two, three, four games that you probably shouldn't have, one or two of those will be in conference, and you've got to put something together that looks different than that.
I think you're right and you're wrong. Way to hedge
your bets, Mango.
No, it comes down to this. If the one win is against Houston or Mississippi State and they end up being top 30 teams, then I think you're wrong. I think you can lose the Utah game and the San Diego State game on the road and still have that resume. As long as you beat those three teams I mentioned before, the three states, Illinois, Weber, and Utah, as long as you do that. I think if you can't beat those two top 30 teams, then you're right. I think you need to beat Utah and San Diego State. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I could buy that.
Because the resume thing is it's about who you beat, right? It's about who you beat. And then if you look at the conference, it's weird now, right? They cut out conference games. So our conference schedule, as of today, looks way better than it did last year because you play Santa Clara and Pepperdine only once, right? And a couple teams, San Diego, San Francisco, look like they might be top 100 teams, which is both good and bad, right? But now if you lose to those guys, it's not like a couple years ago where you're losing to somebody and you're like, well, that's a terrible loss, right? Those losses end up, at least on the road, becoming okay, right? So this new conference schedule, Matt, it seems to be working out, at least on paper, in BYU's favor, because you have two terrible teams that you're only playing once.
Well, and I like some of the way this shook out, right? If you get into the schedule and you see it in January, the first time we're going through the St. Mary's Gonzaga back-to-back, they're a week apart and they're both home games. And I like that. I'd hate to have to play, St. Mary's on a Thursday and then Gonzaga 2 days later.
Well, we're done. We're done with St. Mary's and we still have like a month and a half left in the season.
Yeah.
It's almost 2 months.
So to not have to play that late season game on the road there, but you got to play in Spokane at the end of February, which is going to be a tough trip. But there's a lot of reasons to like this schedule, and I think that if this team can take care of business And in some ways, you've eliminated opportunities to drop a silly game against an opponent you have no business losing to.
Right, right.
You know, that stuff should work in our favor. So you get the quote quality loss because you're gonna drop a couple of these other games.
Yeah, and it's okay if they're if San Diego and San Francisco are actually, like some people believe, top 100 teams this year, which you won't know for a while, right? They've looked good so far in very limited action, right? If they're both top 100 teams, then those losses are fine. If they're like 150, then it's not so great, right? It's not a quote unquote quality loss. It's a bad mark on your resume, right?
Yeah, it's.
But either way, even if you beat them both twice, and they're top 100 teams, that's great, right? Because top 100 wins mean something to the committee, and you know top 75 wins mean something, and so that's good. All right, so let's talk about a few of the key players, man. Obviously, Yoeli Childs, he's the guy, right? He came back to be the guy, and he's the guy, and so far, you know, leading the team in points. And if he can stay out of foul trouble, I think the guy's going to average 20 points a game. Okay, fine. Yep. We talked about TJ Haas already, and we think he could be a big component of this team, but he needs to be more consistent. What about Emery? What do we need out of him this year? Do we need, you know, it's now been a couple years. Do we need that sophomore season was down? Do we just need what he did freshman year, and is that about as best as we can hope for, or does this team need something more out of Emery than that?
You know, I think we need something more out of Emery than that. I think that's the reason you get excited about him coming back. You know, specifically, I think that you need some solid three-point shooting. You need some. Yeah, I think there's some defensive stuff that he can bring to the table. But his average points, you know, if you compare those two seasons, I mean, I feel like there's a big difference between averaging 13 or 16. But I think where you need more than 16 out of him on average if this team really wants to compete and get back to the dance.
Yeah, I think you're going to need some more. And we talked last week, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, we talked about Jashar Hartnett. And so far he is third on the team in scoring in this early going. But he's shooting less than 40% from the field, so that's not necessarily great. So looking at Jashar Hartnett, you know, he didn't have a great year offensively last year. What do we need from him? I'll start with this one, Matt. I think what we need from Hartnett is more consistency. I don't want him taking a lot of three-point shots. I don't think he's shown the ability to do that. Take it when you're open, but not contested. And using his quickness to penetrate and create opportunities for other people in the offense. To me, if he can do that consistently and contribute offensively, he will stay on the court like he has in these first couple of games. But when Emery comes back, if he can't do that, then I think his minutes will be significantly less. And I don't know if we get to the tournament without Hartnett being a significant contributor to this team. Agree or disagree?
I absolutely agree. But one of the things that sticks out to me, if you look at Hartnett's stats, okay, and you go back last year, this is a guy who had 85 defensive rebounds, and in the win against Nevada, he had 4. And so when you're talking about a guard being able to, you know, and I understand, you know, where a guard's picking up those rebounds, but defensive rebounds are a really big deal. And I think the fact that he came away with 4 in that close game against Nevada is telling to what that plays into for the success of this team.
And he's not 6 foot.
No.
I mean, it's kind of remarkable when you think he's a guy that's right now, for his career, averaging near 3 rebounds a game, and he's under 6 feet.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you go back to the 2017-2018 season, he had 96 rebounds, 85 of them were on defense.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not picking up a lot of offensive rebounds.
But defensive rebounds are extremely important if you want to compete. You've got to take away those second chance shots.
Yeah.
So I think that if he can contribute in that way, that's pretty significant to be able to get that type of production off the glass from a point guard who's not, well, a guard who's actually not 6 feet tall.
Well, and he's averaged over his career, his 2 years, at 1 year plus two games, about the same number of rebounds per game as TJ Haas. So, who's 5 inches taller than he is.
Right.
So good points. Good points. One other player I wanted to bring up was Mr. Baxter. So Gavin Baxter, the 6'9 freshman, you know, he's averaging 3 points and 5 boards a game in, you know, 13 minutes so far. I think his role will expand. He was already mentioned on the show by who asked that question earlier? By Travis. Travis asked that question. So what is Baxter? I mean, I think some of these freshmen, probably Baxter being the foremost, somebody's got to step up out of that group. Players we haven't mentioned yet, I'm going to throw Baxter out there as the guy to be a significant, important role player. And then occasionally, you know, have a big game when say, Childs is in foul trouble or maybe just have an off game. Matt, is Baxter that guy for you, or do you got somebody else that you think is going to be a key component?
I think if you look at the numbers and from what we've been able to see so far, I think Baxter is that guy in the eyes of the coaches. And so what you have to hope is that he's going to be able to live up to that and produce what they're looking for.
Yeah. And obviously Celius, if he could be, you know, that dead-eye three-point shooter that he was before his mission, could be a big part of it. McKay Cannon, who showed a little bit last year but hasn't, at least in these first couple games, done a whole lot. And then, of course, Emery will see what he can contribute. So, Matt, now we get to talk about my favorite thing. Before we do that, where will they finish in the WCC? Are they going to win second place, or is this going to be another third-place year for the Cougars?
I feel like this is I'm saying this is a third-place team.
I'm going to say second. That's my prediction. That has to do with, I think we'll be better, and I think St. Mary's will be worse, right? So it's not just about us.
And your shots, I feel like, and maybe if I go back and look at the schedule historically, maybe it always feels this way, but I feel like being done with St. Mary's on January 24th,
yeah.
Like, if you're counting on your team to kind of gel and get better towards the back end of the season, then you should be nervous about the fact that we're getting both of those games out of the way in the month of January. I'd love to play one of those games in February when the team has had more time to figure stuff out. Because I feel like we have this conversation every year. The early part of that schedule, Rose is tinkering with lineups and he's moving people around. You know, here Emery's going to be a little bit late coming in, at least in game situations. And so, to me, I feel like I'd be more comfortable with St. Mary's and the possibility that we take one or both of those if we had one of them later in the year.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I think usually he's got his rotation set in that first little bit of the
by the time we get into the conference
play. So I'm not worried about that. I don't care where they play the games, because you'll have your ups and downs throughout the season, and they could go on a January hot streak. I don't know. I mean, it really comes down to me. It really comes down to that second place versus third place thing: is how good is St. Mary's this year or not, and how much better are we than last year? If the answer to either of those questions is we're not that much better, or St. Mary's is as good as they were last year, then the answer is third, right? I mean, Gonzaga's the king of the mountain; they're not going anywhere, and they're going to be, you know, a top 10 team and dominating all year. So Matt, let's talk about the NCAA. Okay, so after we finished recording last week, the NCAA handed down penalties to BYU. They got on probation, loss of a scholarship, all these things that we've talked about. Jeremy Ashton asked us via email, what does it mean that BYU basketball is on probation for the next couple of years? It basically means don't do anything bad for the next couple of years.
It's like double secret probation?
It actually, I don't know if it means anything, to be honest.
You're going to ignore my Animal House reference?
Is that Animal House?
Yeah, double secret probation.
No, that's not Animal House.
Yeah,
that's
it is.
Naked Gun.
No, it's not. It's Animal House. I'm Googling this right now.
Double secret probation.
Yeah, definitely Animal House.
Oh. Why did I think it was Naked Gun?
I don't know.
Huh. Anyway.
But I feel like it's really applicable to this
it is kind of applicable to it. So Emory ended up getting about $12,000 in benefits or whatever the final number was. Most of it after the years we're going to have to vacate. But BYU came out swinging, Matt, and basically said they thought this punishment was over the top and also unprecedented. And we'll get to that here in a second. But Andre Hutchins on Twitter, @AC_Hutchins, said, "Can the stupidity of the NCAA ruling on Nick Emory be quantified? If so, quantify it. How many recent NCAA rule violations have occurred at big-name schools without harsh..." What is he trying to say there? Sanctions.
Sanctions.
He misspelled it. That's all right. "If any at all. Here's looking at you, North Carolina and Arizona," he says. "P.S. Emory knew better." We'll get to the Emory knew better here in a second. But I'm about to go on epic rant. Are you ready?
Yeah, I feel like rant? I should just get out of the way and let you get this out of your system.
No, you need to add, too. You need to add, too. But here's where I'm at, okay? Right now, the FBI is investigating a bunch of schools for basically paying players through shoe companies, right? And including doing things that are illegal, not just breaking NCAA bylaws, right? All of these things are going down, okay? So how does the NCAA respond? They punish a team where there was no loss of institutional control, just a couple of boosters doing things they shouldn't have been doing, and a player doing things he shouldn't have been doing, by their rules. You and I have have the same thoughts. We just on whether these rules are any good or not. But Emory knew the rules were what they were. I'm sure the boosters had a good idea what they were doing.
Yeah.
So these mistakes were made. Fine. Okay. So broke the NCAA rules. But there was in the report very clearly that the school rose. There was not a systematic breakdown like there have been in other situations where there was this culture of guys getting stuff, right, everywhere.
Or where they've discovered that coaches were handing players money.
Or facilitating it by, you know, not handing the money but talking to the booster about handing the money, right?
Right.
Any of that stuff, none of that's here. So vacating wins, by the way, I think is the dumbest freaking thing ever. The wins happened. Reggie Bush won a Heisman, right? They won a national title. Taking it away is insane to me, right? And you're punishing a bunch of players that had nothing to do with it, okay, on top of all these other things. But here's what I have to say to the NCAA. All these high-profile teams are doing this every freaking day. What Emory got is chump change to what's happening at every major top 50 college basketball program, probably every year. And that's why I find this to take a self-reported problem and to make it into this big deal and big punishment. This should have been Emory suspended and you're put on probation. That's it. We're done. That's all you needed to do here, NCAA, and then you walk away. Instead, you're going to have them vacate wins, take away a scholarship, which I guess was what BYU said they should do, right? But all of this stuff is insane to me. And the whole amateurism, all of this garbage, we got, we've got Bobby Petrino, I know it's a different sport, who's going to get a buyout of like $14 million for running Louisville's football program into the friggin' ground, right? And we're having this like high-minded stuff. And here's the thing: what happens when they don't do anything to Louisville or Arizona or any of these other schools? Because yeah, they broke laws; these people broke laws, but there were no NCAA violations, right? How are we going to feel when that happens? And then here's the piece that really annoys me: is North Carolina.
Here we go.
They created classes at a very good academic institution to be easy so that athletes could take them and pass them and not have to take real classes at a school that's difficult, right? UNC Chapel Hill is known as a really good academic program.
It's a good school.
Really good school. And because that's not against the bylaws, it ends up doing nothing.
Well, because the distinction there was that those classes were also available. These fake classes were available to non-student athletes.
Well, great. Then let this booster take some random kid on a vacation to Europe. Right?
Well, I would argue that people do that. Regular student athletes get gifts, and people might
go
on vacation.
You mean regular students?
Sure.
Not regular student athletes.
It happens all of the time.
It does happen all the time. But here's the thing. This does not harm the academic integrity of that of BYU. A booster taking Nick Emery and his ex-wife to Europe, right? There's no harm to the academic integrity. Creating classes so that athletes can take them and not actually be athletes, not actually be students, that should be something where the NCAA goes, hey, we know that there were no bylaws broken, but here's this. You fix this or we're going to shut your freaking program down, right? Like, to me, it's a million times worse than what happened, and they get nothing. And Emery basically makes a couple of dumb mistakes, gets suspended, took a year off, by the way. Probably now that we know all the details, I don't think it was probably all about his mental health and his personal life, though I'm sure there was a big chunk of that. And his brother's now paid it all back. It's insane, Matt. The whole NCAA is insane. And they should just blow the whole thing up and start over. I just can't. I mean, the fact that BYU is getting punished to a level that's never been done before is also insane. And I can't wait till we find out that someday that these investigators just don't like BYU. Some of these guys that pass this down. Like, because I can't come up with another reasonable explanation as to why BYU is getting hammered worse than other programs for doing less.
Well, and I think that's the thing, too, is if you go into the BYU statement, and there's a couple of things that they point out which very clearly, which are in no other similar case where the NCAA discovered that there was no institutional knowledge of the things that have taken place, nor did they find that the staff or the school was promoting an environment of non-compliance or whatever the stupid phrase is. No penalty was imposed, right? Like, no wins were vacated in situations like this. It's just insane to me that the NCAA is deciding now, with everything that they have going on, right? This is the hill that they want to die on.
Yeah,
right?
This is the hammer they're going to bring down.
It's just insane. I don't want to go too hard on the we're victims here, but like it's kind of like they're trying to send a signal out, like, hey, like, and we're being made an example of, because they know that it is about to hit the fan. And I think their whole case about promoting amateurism and all this stuff is getting to a point where it's going to be on very shaky ground. And they are this is them trying to claw back some authority and some power and demonstrate that they really are serious about enforcing some of these rules, when you have the FBI out here discovering that there's this whole world of stuff going on that the NCAA has decided to ignore for years.
Yeah, that's the piece. What you just said is what pisses me off more than anything else, is that has been going on where shoe companies and other handlers were paying tens of thousands of dollars, was exchanging hands, not to the kid, to benefit the kid in most cases. It was to benefit somebody else to steer the kid to the program. Okay? That has been going on. And we've been talking about that since, what was that terrible movie with Shaquille O'Neal and Penny Hardaway?
Blue Chip.
We've been talking about this crap for 30 years, right? And the NCAA never did anything to clean it up. It's now even worse, possibly, than it was. Or maybe it's worse because now the players aren't getting as much of the money because everybody watches them. And now it's floating to third parties who don't do anything, who create no value, right? They're not coaches. Well, sometimes they're AAU coaches. But they're third-party intermediaries that point a kid to something and get $75,000 out of it, right? I'd much rather see that kid get the $75,000, right? Like, the NCAA, like, created this problem by, like, basically watchdogging Cam Newton and everybody else, right? And if they even, you know, if, and we got the Salt Lake Tribune hiding out in cars, making sure Emery's not driving a Jetta he's not supposed to drive, right?
I think, like, it was a beige Jetta. I mean, could, listen, if we're going to have NCAA infractions, could this be any more BYU?
It couldn't. It couldn't be.
Like, he's driving a used beige Jetta?
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Come on.
And vacations with his wife, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, this is the, it couldn't be any more BYU.
Now, but like the money in the locker room, like, listen, the rules here are clear, right? And Emery should have known better. I do want to say that. I don't agree with the rules. I think that the rules should just wholesale be thrown out. But these are the rules that we're playing under. And he knew that he knew that those were the rules when he did these things.
If the booster that left the $200 in his locker, that guy should never be allowed anywhere near the athletic programs ever again.
Correct. And I think that's part of what BYU has said they're doing, is they're disassociating all four of the boosters.
Well, one of them wasn't a booster, though. BYU didn't. I don't think BYU said all four. I think they said two. I'd have to go back.
The one guy is like, it's a pretty loot. Like, the definition that the NCAA uses for booster requires no discussion on amount of money donated nor timing of when it was donated. And I think the booster number four in the report is a guy who donated $650 to the university like 15 or 20 years ago.
Not to the athletic program, to the university.
Right. Which is insane.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be like calling me a booster because I've donated to some campaigns a couple of times.
But everybody who saw, who had the unfortunate circumstance of seeing the movie Blue Chip, starring Shaquille O'Neal and Penny Hardaway and whatever that the coach
Nick
guy
Nolte,
was.
I think, Nick Nolte, was the coach.
I think you're correct. Everybody knows that you can't take Nick Emery to lunch at the country club and pay for him to play golf. Like, you know you can't do that, right? Like, don't do that.
No, and these and a couple of these idiot boosters have put the program at risk, right?
Yeah.
And I agree with you. The rules are insane and dumb and need to get revised. But Nick Emery and the boosters knew better, and they broke the rules, right?
But
I don't even know why, because it's not like Emery was already here. Like, you weren't luring him to the program. Right.
I think these are people that they want to be part of and connected to the program. They want to have an in and a relationship with these players. There's nothing here that's saying that any of these guys were trying to steer him towards an agent or any of these other things, which are normally the reasons you would do this type of stuff, right?
Right.
And that is really what the NCAA is after, are people like that that are trying to get this guy, kind of like what the shoe company's been doing, that are trying to steer them in some other type of direction or stand to benefit from some decision that Emery is going to make. And from everything that I've been able to see here, there is nothing like that here. And the key component of this whole thing is that the NCAA themselves have drawn the conclusion that Rose nor anyone on the staff had any idea that any of these things had happened, and nobody inside the program was at all aware of what was going on. And that to me is the key, right? Like, Nick Emery made a couple of real boneheaded decisions that, during a time in his life, it sounds like he had some other things going on outside of basketball that may have been involved in his decision making. Okay, let's just say that. But he made that decision independent of the program, and so to say we're going to, on top of all this, pretend like these 47 wins never happened, like we're going to go and climb into the DeLorean, right, and take these 47 wins away. I mean, that punishment is silly to me. Like, that doesn't even make any sense.
I don't like doing the vacating wins when there was institutional issues, because it, two reasons. The first one is they freaking happened. It's history. I you can't rewrite history. Those games happen, right? One team won, one team lost. You can't give a team a win because somebody, they didn't cheat in the game, right? They cheated according to some terrible rules. The second thing is, you're punishing a bunch of players who had nothing to do with any of it, right? And I hate that kind of punishment. Punish the people that did the wrong. You want to be like real men in NCAA. Don't let idiots like Bobby Petrino come back into your fraternity, right? Don't let Patino come back into your fraternity. But they don't care. They don't actually care about any of this. You hit it on the head. They're trying to protect their frickin' pocketbooks. That's what this is about. They don't want to give the players any money. And if this breaks down and they have to start paying the players, all of a sudden the NCAA business model doesn't look as good, and as the coaches won't make as much money, right? Because right now you funnel it all to the coaches because there's nowhere else to funnel it, right? Facilities and all this other stuff.
Here's the thing. They don't have to – the NCAA, if they were just pull their heads out, they don't have to pay the players. All they have to do is let the shoe companies and the Nikes and Under Armours of the world pay the players. That's all they need to do.
Or the local car dealership.
Yes. Let them go. Yeah, let them go advertise for the sandwich shop. Let them go do those things, and that's it. It all goes away. Yeah, it all goes away. You're protecting amateurism for the sake of your definition of amateurism, which for no other good reason. And big-time college sports have just evolved beyond that.
Oh, yeah.
And so the market is working around you, and you're clamoring for some level of control because you're worried your kingdom's going to fall down, and the solution is actually not that complicated.
It's actually very straightforward. Well, Matt, we are bordering on our longest podcast ever. So we'll have more to say on this because there's an appeal that BYU is going to do, and they're going to fight this. I don't know what chances they have at winning. But obviously, I think this is going to hang over the program for a while, right? The 2 years probation for sure. But it's a black eye. But I think the BYU made it very clear by signing Rose to an extension right before this announcement, and they had to know it was coming, right? That Dave Rose isn't going anywhere, right? He's not getting fired because of this.
No, yeah, they clearly have faith in Dave Rose and agree with the NCAA that he had no idea what was going on.
That he had no idea. So anyway, well, Matt, we'll be on there at halftime, or at least, I don't know, will you be there? I'll be there on halftime on Saturday, I think.
Oh, yeah, let's do this.
Let's do it. Well, at least we got a couple more halftime
shows. Beat the Aggies. Let's beat some Aggies.
Yeah, let's not lose to all Aggies, okay? Just lose to one Aggie a year. So anyway, thank you everybody for downloading and listening. You can check out this podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast listening service. You can, of course, join us for that live halftime show at facebook.com/riseandshout. Thank you for downloading and listening, and we will catch you next time.
Go Cougars!